Okay. The court calls United States versus Cozad, 23-233, and we have Ms. Brannon and Mr. Parker, and we'll hear from Ms. Brannon.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. Melody Brannon, I'm the federal public defender for the District of Kansas representing Ms. Cozad. Today, there is a single issue before this court, and that is whether the district court procedurally erred when it imposed a higher sentence because Ms. Cozad had not reached a mutually beneficial plea agreement with the government. Whether the parties reached a plea agreement standing alone is an impermissible sentencing factor that is wholly unrelated to the legitimate goals of sentencing set forth in 3553A. When the district court made this pronouncement, it was a general pronouncement that was not tethered to the an individual assessment of the factors of this case, and it was not tied to any 3553 factor. Instead, it was a pronouncement that the court's usual practice was to anchor the sentence at a higher point in the guidelines in the absence of a plea agreement, and it's in turn usual practice to grant additional credit for entering into a plea agreement without any consideration of what the terms of the agreement might be or the reasons that there was not a plea agreement in this particular case. This case is particularly consequential because open pleas are not uncommon, and they are in fact sanctioned and recognized by Rule 11. What the court did when it made this pronouncement was it signaled to all litigants that it would look more favorably upon any defendant who acquiesced to a government's terms in a plea agreement, regardless of what those terms were and regardless of the course of negotiations. It has already obliged defense counsel in the District of Kansas to advise our clients appearing before this district court that this court looks more favorably if they are to reach an agreement with the government and less favorably if you are just to plead it. Even with all of the rights that are waived with an open plea, including the right to trial, and all of the trial rights that go along with that and all of the waivers that are recognized in Glass versus United States. The other thing that this general pronouncement did is it strengthened the government's plea bargaining position, because now that the government recognizes and knows that the government favors plea agreements, it has... for the government and against...
Ms. Brannon, let me stop you. Karen, would you give an additional a minute on Ms. Brannon's time? You don't know this, Ms. Brannon, but whatever you just said for the last minute, none of us could hear you. At least I couldn't hear you. So if you can back up a little bit
Certainly, Your Honor.
We couldn't hear what you just said.
Is it sound good now?
Perfect.
Okay. Just going back, I would say that the case is consequential because it is not uncommon to have open pleas in the District of Kansas, and open pleas are in fact sanctioned by Rule 11. The difficulty and the complications raised by the court's announcement of its practice, its usual practice, is that it signals to litigants in the District of Kansas that the court looks more favorably upon a defendant that acquiesces to the terms of a government's plea agreement and less favorably on those who plead open, even with all of the waivers that go along with an open plea.
But isn't the district court correct that it shows a greater acceptance of responsibility if you agree? I mean, your client wanted probation, and I assume that's all that was agreeable.
Whether the court imposed a sentence of prison or probation was the only issue before the court, but I do not believe that entering into a plea agreement shows a greater acceptance of responsibility. In fact, I think by pleading open without getting any concession from the government is more of an acceptance of responsibility. You're pleading as charged. You are not getting a charge bargain. You are not getting consideration for cooperation or any of the other hypothetical scenarios that the government had in its response brief. So it is an open plea is not tied to acceptance of responsibility. But more importantly, the court in this case did not tie it to Ms. Cozad's acceptance of responsibility. It's usual.
She's frozen again.
I know. Ms. Karen, go ahead and stop the clock if you would. And Ms. Brannon, I don't know if you can hear us. We cannot hear you. Your image and your audio is frozen. Ms. Brannon, I don't know if you can hear. I think she logged off, and I'll try to get back on.
Yeah, I'll watch for her and readmit her.
Okay. And Karen, if you have Ms. Brannon's number, you know, perhaps you can call or text her.
Oh, there she is.
She's coming back. Okay. Ms. Brannon, can you hear us? Oh, you're on mute. I think.
Oh, apologize, Your Honor. I'm not sure what happened there.
Well, you know, unless your name is Wi-Fi, it's not your fault. So we're going to give you, Karen, let's give her another 45 seconds. And I don't know if you remember, you won't know where we stopped hearing you, but we stopped hearing you at some point.
That's all right, Your Honor. I will pick up. I was saying that the court's pronouncement necessarily strengthens the government's bargaining position in all cases, because the government knows that this is the particular personal preference of this court.
Even conceding that, and I see your point on that, mm-hmm. is that a valid consideration in an individual sentencing such as this one?
It is any time that the court is engaging in sort of a direct bargaining with defendants about what the sentence or the plea agreement is, it's a concern because of the imbalance. The other, you know, whether there is a plea agreement or not has nothing to do with the 3553 factors that the court is supposed to consider. And what we have here implicates Rule 11, which Rule 11 says that the court is not to be a party and not to participate in plea negotiations. But by making this general pronouncement, the court has necessarily injected its preference for plea agreements into all negotiations. The government going forward knows that if that's the court's preference, there's an incentive for the defendant to enter into a plea agreement. And so it has necessarily more bargaining power. We have a judicial thumb on the scale in plea negotiations, which is Rule 11 said that we should not do. One of the other complications of this is that
Ms. Brannon, before you go to the other complications, and I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but on what you just were articulating, I have a hypothetical question is, you know, let's leave the defendant out of it for the time being. And let's say hypothetically, I'm a defendant in Judge Melgren's court, and he says, that defendant Bob Bacharach, you entered into a plea agreement, and I am generally familiar with all of the representations, the concessions that go along with being a part of that agreement. So, defendant Bacharach, I'm going to give you the bottom of the guideline range, and the government appeals and says that's not a permissible factor under 3553A. And the and appeals the procedural reasonableness of the sentence as overly lenient. And how does Judge Brannon in that case? I've just appointed you to the court. How do you rule on that? Did Judge Melgren abuse his discretion by giving me a break and giving me to the low end of the guideline range?
I think it depends on the information before Judge Melgren in terms of an individualized assessment of the facts of the case. If there was something specific in that plea agreement that went to defendant Bacharach that showed, for example, an extraordinary acceptance of responsibility because he had a valid appeal that he probably would have prevailed on and he gave that up, I think that's acceptable, and that is a permissible sentencing factor because it is directly tied to 3553 and because it is specific to that case. If the court says, I am just generally going to give credit to anybody that pleads guilty under these circumstances without consideration of what those terms are in a particular plea agreement, I think that is problematic. And that's what we have here.
Okay. And I think it is getting to the heart of your argument, but let me probe that a little bit deeper. It seems to me that the dividing point here is whether or not using the entry of a plea agreement is a rational benchmark for assuming a variety of concessions that defendants typically make under the abuse of discretion standard. And I know you know it as well as anyone. It has to be arbitrary, whimsical, manifestly unreasonable. Now, why would it be considered manifestly unreasonable or whimsical or arbitrary for a judge to say, I've been a judge for a long time. I've been in the United States Attorney's Office. I know what concessions are typically made in these plea agreements, and I'm just going to make this benchmark that there are going to be some concessions that are typically associated with that, and I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to the defendants that enter into that plea agreement. I'm not going to be harsher to anybody else, but I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to these defendants. What's wrong with that? What's manifestly unreasonable about that?
It's manifestly unreasonable because by just generalizing, a plea agreement is going to get additional credit without looking to actually the terms of the plea agreement and what is specific to this case. It is an impermissible factor, and the law has held that it's procedurally unreasonable to rely on an impermissible factor. I think what is clear here is that the economics of plea negotiations can be very varied and very complicated in cases. It might be that you are talking about concurrent sentences. It might be that you're talking about credit for time served. I mean, there are so many variables that can go into a true plea agreement. What is important is that in an actual plea agreement, that there is a bargain for consideration on both sides, and that this is a contract between the parties and not a contract that includes the court as a party. And by making just plea agreements generally something that the court considers, it has introduced an impermissible factor in its sentencing, whether it is credit for someone who has entered a plea agreement or a harsher sentence for someone who has chosen not to. It gets more complicated because when there is not a plea agreement, then it opens up the reasons that there is not a plea agreement. Who is it that made the offer? Who is it that rejected the offer, and why did they reject the offer? Under this scenario, if the government chooses not to offer a plea agreement at all to a defendant, which it is entitled to do, is that held against that defendant? Because one of the things here that is clear is that the district court held Ms. Cozad responsible for not having a plea agreement, and not that the government's responsible for not having a plea agreement, when in fact it should be a mutually beneficial agreement between the parties. And by holding Ms. Cozad responsible without making any further inquiry, was impermissible to do in this case. But by allowing the presence of a plea agreement to become a permissible factor, which in fact no court has ever done, it will open up that complication to us always wanting to explain to the court what the course of the plea negotiations were, what the economy was, what the factors were, and why or why not we could reach a plea agreement. And all of that suddenly implicates Rule 11 and introduces the court into the reasons that a plea is reached or not reached. And for the court to make this general pronouncement that I am going to be more lenient if there is a plea agreement without regard to the facts of the case or the nature of that plea agreement is what makes it impermissible in this case.
I don't follow what you say as far as plea negotiations, because if we're keeping it to an individual case, which I think we should, and this whole discussion is occurring long after the plea was entered. It's at sentencing, right? And so how is the district court injecting itself in plea negotiations when the plea's 3 months old?
In this particular case, the impermissible factor that the court relied on was just the absence of a plea agreement. We're not claiming a Rule 11 violation here. But what we're saying is that the court refused to give credit to Ms. Cozad and treated her differently simply because there was not a plea agreement, without regard to why there wasn't a plea agreement, with regard to whose for there not being a plea agreement. without regard for what the plea negotiations actually were. For example, if the government had said, I'm not going to offer a plea agreement in this case, and the court was not aware of it, Ms. Cozad would be more punished more harshly for that.
Well, she'd get a chance to say, I wanted a plea agreement and the government wouldn't give me one for any number of reasons, including the government has a policy. It won't have a written plea agreement unless I waive my appeal.
And I think that when we get into those reasons that we have a plea agreement or don't have a plea agreement, we are on impermissible grounds and we are running counter to what the purpose of Rule 11 was, which was to keep the court out of judging whether certain terms of a plea agreement are acceptable or not acceptable. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, Karen, let's stop the clock for Ms. Brannon. So we're not eating into your time. Judge Phillips, do you have any follow-up questions?
Nothing.
Okay, Judge Seymour, do you? Okay, Mr. Parker.
Thank you, and good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Parker for the United States. I'd like to make a few points in response to the defendant's argument. First, it was quite clear that what the district court did here was simply to deny an additional measure of leniency to Ms. Cozad.
What if the district court said, I'm going to deny an additional measure of leniency, or however you want to characterize it, because you didn't sign a plea agreement, and I look at those plea agreements to see if someone waived an appeal. And by gosh, if they don't waive an appeal in my court, they're going to get the mid-range. Would you defend that?
I mean, the way that you have pitched it, Judge Phillips, I think that would be much harder to defend. That is certainly not at all what the court did here. I think that...
How do we know? What the district court said is he likes a written plea agreement because of quote-unquote additional conditions that are obtained in them. That's one thing that's oftentimes in a plea, written plea agreement is a waiver of appeal. May very well be what the district court wants to see.
Right. But I think there were other things the court said as well. And I think it's important to keep those in mind. The court explained that it views the middle of the range as the appropriate starting point in most cases, and that it is inclined to look more at the bottom of the range in cases where there is a plea agreement in order to give, and these are direct quotes, additional credit and additional consideration to those defendants based on the concessions that are often made in plea agreements.
Like what concessions? I just named one, which is the waiver of right of appeal. What else are you considering?
Well, I think the waiver of appeal is one of them. An agreement to a full and complete description of offense conduct is another, which did not happen in this case.
Which is beyond 3E1.1, right?
No, I don't think. I'm sorry.
3E1.1 requires the defendant to admit the relevant conduct of that offense and not any additional. Now, you as the government could say, we're not giving you a plea agreement unless you tell us all sorts of stuff. In fact, here's your factual basis, and it's going to extend way past. So to hold a defendant to signing that or else get an increased sentence, whether you want to characterize it as leniency or whatever term you want, that doesn't smell right to me.
Respectfully, Judge Phillips, I don't think that's what happened here, but I also think that there are good reasons to allow courts to do precisely that. The various concessions that are made in a plea agreement do speak very directly to the Section 3553A factors. An appeal waiver is a very good example, as this court explained in its opinion in Tania Arana. That demonstrates an added measure of acceptance of responsibility, not in the technical sense that it is used in the guidelines. And Ms. Cozad satisfied the guidelines requirements for acceptance of responsibility and got the 2-point reduction as a result, but rather in a broader sense of someone who is willing to not only admit the bare minimum necessary to establish the essential elements of the offense and avoid a trial, but instead is willing to fully explain her offense conduct, not leaving gaps and suspicious circumstances unexplained. Someone who is willing to say, not only am I going to accept the conviction, but I'm going to accept my sentence and I am going to attempt to reform and turn my life around. Now, Ms. Kazat did argue.
Now you are defending the ability to compel a notice or a waiver of appeal.
Not to compel it, no, but I think...
Let's say this. If you don't sign a plea agreement that has additional considerations, one of which is waiving your right to appeal, you get the high end. But if you do sign one, then you get additional leniency, which is the low end, which is a lot. In a lot of cases, that's a lot of months. Compel's not too strong a word, is it?
I don't think it is. And I think the Supreme Court has explained this in cases like Bordenkercher and Corbett. It's not, a defendant is not compelled to agree to a plea agreement simply because he knows that he is much more likely to get a lenient sentence if he signs it. And I think that this court explained the same thing in its Vanderwerf decision. The main point here is that there are a number of things that a court can rightly conclude about a defendant under Section 3553A that relate directly to the concessions that a defendant may make in a plea agreement. And on the flip side, when those concessions aren't seen in a case, it makes sense that the court would say, I don't find that you are as worthy of leniency as you might be if you had made those concessions.
Mr. Platt,
yes.
Let me ask you a question. There's discussion about being forthcoming, about waiving your right to an appeal. If I, where in the record on appeal can I go to find any indication of what agreements or concessions that Judge Milgren thinks are typically associated with a plea agreement, or what he thinks that that defendants in the District of Kansas typically agree to in plea agreements? I didn't see anything in the record about what agreements are typically or concessions are typically part of plea agreements in Kansas, what Judge Milgren is talking about. I see what you think Judge Milgren is talking about. I see what Ms. Brannon thinks Judge Milgren is talking about. To be candid, I don't have the slightest idea what Judge Milgren is talking about. And so I don't know how I can evaluate the reasonableness of his use of entry or not of a plea agreement as a benchmark for being forthcoming. Or acceptance of responsibility like in Tina Arena. So am I wrong? Did I overlook that in the record?
No, you didn't, Judge Bacharach. And that is true that the district court did not go through the various concessions. I think that it is fair to assume that the court is referring to the ordinary concessions. I mean, Judge Milgren is an experienced district court judge and knows what types of concessions are usually contained in plea agreements.
I have to confess, I don't know how Judge Seymour and I in Oklahoma and Judge Phillips in Wyoming are supposed to know if it's not in the record, if it's not part of the transcript, if it's not part of the explanation. Maybe Judge Milgren knows, maybe you and Ms. Brannon knows, but I don't have the foggiest idea how any of us are supposed to know what concessions are typically part of the plea agreements offered by the United States Attorney's Office or agreed to in the District of Kansas. And so I don't know how to evaluate that.
I appreciate that concern, Judge Bacharach, but I do think that there are a couple of important points here. One, we are dealing with a within-guideline sentence, and so the requirement that the district court provide a lengthy explanation is not there. But more importantly, there are, as I think this court's cases demonstrate, common agreements in plea agreements, especially an appeal waiver, a full and complete statement of facts, that a defendant could agree to and would warrant additional leniency. And that's all Judge Milgren, I think, was talking about here.
Does the District of Kansas always require an appeal waiver?
I don't think that is always required. And I would like to push back on one thing that Ms. Brannon said. There was nothing in the sentencing explanation here that suggests that the court thought that it would always look more favorably on pleas no matter what. no matter what conditions those contain. Certainly, the court never said that it would apply the same rule to a defendant who might not have had the opportunity to enter a plea because the district or the government did not want to discuss a plea. Quite the opposite. The court explained this was not a hard and fast rule, and it said it's also just one of the factors that it looks to in deciding whether that defendant merits additional leniency and additional credit in the form of a low-end guideline sentence. And there were a number of other factors.
So can I stop you? I apologize, but I don't want you to lose your train of thought. But I did want to ask you, are you insinuating that Judge Milgren might very well have typically done something a little different than here and said, well, Ms. Cozad, did they offer you a plea agreement and ask the United States Attorney's Office if they offered a plea agreement, and that might be a mitigating circumstance that might induce Judge Milgren to give the low end? If so, it seems to me that Ms. Brannon may have a legitimate concern about interjecting the judge in plea negotiations. That seems totally inappropriate to me.
No, I would just
be asking about plea offers and why the defendant didn't agree to a plea.
I would disagree with that, Judge Bacharach, for a couple of reasons. One is the district court was well aware of why Ms. Cozad did not enter into a plea agreement. Ms. Cozad admitted it in her sentencing memorandum, where she said, I wanted the government to agree to probation, the lowest possible sentence that could be imposed, way below the guidelines. And when the government made a counteroffer, and the reason they made that counteroffer was because the facts simply did not warrant probation and it was unreasonably low, as the district court itself later determined. As soon as the government made that counteroffer, that was the end of it. There was no further discussion about entry into a plea on some other terms. Instead, the defendant simply announced that she was going to enter a straight-up plea. Now, that is her right, but the district court, I think, was also entitled to say, look, there are concessions that might warrant additional leniency. I don't see them in this case. It also, though, I want to point out, relied on other factors, too. It relied on Ms. Cozad's extraordinarily long criminal history. It relied on the fact that she had numerous violations of her pretrial conditions of pretrial release. I also think that there are, although the court did not specifically address this, there are a number of other reasons why relying on a plea agreement of this sort is permissible, as this and other courts have already said. I mean, I would direct you to the Ninth Circuit's decision in Reina Rodriguez, in which it specifically noted the uniformity concerns that arise here, which brings me to the third point that I wanted to raise, which is I know that the defendant has suggested that somehow the government is trying to expand its ability to rely on plea agreements and doing something unusual in this case. I actually think it is quite the opposite. Every defendant knows that the reason that you make certain concessions in a plea is because you're hoping to get a lower sentence. And as the Ninth Circuit explained, if this court were to hold that of all of the factors under 3553A and 3661, the entire universe of factors that a court can consider, this one is off limits, it would significantly change the calculus for entering into plea agreements in this circuit. It would, I think, rob a lot of those concessions of much of their force because it would remove the incentives that defendants have to make them.
What are the additional considerations that you would have wanted in a written plea agreement that should have borne on the length of the sentence?
I think there are a couple. One, I think, would be an appeal waiver. The second would be a full and complete statement of facts. As we've explained, there were a number of circumstances in this case that Ms. Cozad never explained or even attempted to explain. She took the position that her culpability was the absolute minimum you could possibly imagine, that she had allowed her roommates, who in reality are mostly teenagers who were peers of her son, living with her and her husband.
Well, you must see the problem. And the problem is that when you start demanding all of these facts beyond what 3E1.1 requires, which is the elements of the offense, then guess what? The guideline range can go up. A specific offense characteristic here, an adjustment there.
No, I think that this is outside the realm of what the guidelines contemplate. The guidelines contemplate
relevant conduct, and relevant conduct affects base offense levels, adjustments, and so forth. And accordingly, if you're demanding additional facts beyond what the defendant is required for to provide as part of acceptance of responsibility, the defendant risks an increased sentence. I don't know how you can say otherwise.
Well, I think that is true, but that is only true because the more that a defendant is willing to admit and explain, the lower his sentence or her sentence may be. It may warrant additional leniency when a defendant comes into court and says, I'm willing to not only admit to the very minimum, I see my time has expired. May I finish my thought?
Please do. Yes.
When a defendant comes into court and says, I'm not just going to admit to the bare minimum I need to admit to avoid a trial. I'm going to fully explain myself, and I'm going to accept the court's judgment, and I'm going to accept the sentence, and I'm going to try to rehabilitate. Those things have value, and they are absent when a defendant enters a straight up plea like the one that Ms. Cazade entered. And for that reason, we think that the district court was within the district court's discretion to say, I am not going to treat you the same as I would treat someone who did make concessions. Thank you.
Judge Phillips, do you have any other questions?
Oh, thank you.
Judge Seymour? Okay. Ms. Brandon, I think, yeah, you have a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will start with a factual error by the government, which there was an agreed factual basis in this case. It was stated on the record, the government approved of it, and it shows sort of the problems with the non-record hypotheticals of the government, which is when you go, you know, past the record, there was in fact an agreed factual basis here. And more than that, Ms. Cazade did not object to any of the facts that were in the PSR. And finally, the government below was not saying she had not fully accepted responsibility or had not conceded any facts that the government below felt were important. Secondly, the court below relied on criminal history and pretrial violations to deny probation, but it was very clear, and the court was, it appears, intentionally specific, saying the mid-guideline range rather than the low-guideline range that the government was recommending below is because there was no plea agreement in this case. Third is that every defendant coming before the district court now knows that the district court values a plea agreement and will be more lenient on someone that reaches a plea agreement. And with this, I'd refer to the United States versus Vanderwerf, which the government suggested. And in that, the Tenth Circuit said, simply stated, the district court's personal policy preferences on plea bargainings are irrelevant. And they are, in fact, irrelevant. But more than that, they're impermissible under 3553. The thing that I would ask the court to be very careful of is equating an appellate waiver with acceptance of responsibility. Of course, we don't know that it was an appellate waiver that was really at issue here. And, you know, there are times that we plead conditionally and there is not an appellate waiver. But an appellate waiver is not a static term. It means a lot of different things. And it is extraordinarily broad. It is not just waiver of direct appeal review. In Kansas, a general appellate waiver includes your waiver of the right to appeal a sentence imposed on a supervised release violation that has not yet occurred. There are districts where an appellate waiver includes your waiver of your right to claim compassionate release, of your right to argue for guidelines retroactivity if that comes into play. So it is not just about acceptance of responsibility. But again, here, the reason that there was the mid-guideline range was given here was simply because there was not a plea agreement in place. And that was the court's general practice and general pronouncement. For this reason, we asked the court to vacate and remand.
Thank you, Ms. Brandon. Judge Seymour, do you have any questions?
Thanks.
Judge Phillips? All right. This matter will be submitted. The briefing and the advocacy today were just absolutely stellar. Thank you both for your excellent advocacy. This matter is submitted.